I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. One of the nastier tyrannies in the world has our attention all anew this summer. North Korea picked our 4th of July holiday to brag that it's got missiles now to deliver a bomb to the U.S. heartland. And then on Labor Day weekend this month, it tested a nuclear warhead 7 times bigger than the one we dropped on Hiroshima to end World War II. This week, North Korea fired a missile over northern Japan into the Pacific. So a strangely familiar old nightmare is back. A nuclear-tipped hornet's nest in the attic of the world. It would be suicide, of course, to fire it up. Maybe another sort of suicide to attack it. What we get are words to remember while we're trying to think. Fire and fury like the world has never seen from President Trump, feeling threatened. From Pyongyang this week, the riposte was ashes and darkness for the U.S., and while they're at it, they'll sink Japan into the sea like an old barge as payback for new sanctions against North Korea. Who is to decode this language to get to some truth of intentions and interests, a real history and present danger behind those words? Evan Osnos of The New Yorker magazine has taken a brave stab at the questions on the ground in the sealed city of Pyongyang. Nothing at all, he says, like any scene he's watched in Egypt or China or Moscow in the Cold War. He has filled half the magazine this week with straightforwardly complicated answers.
Part of the puzzle of this particular confrontation is that it is without ideology. If you think about it, the Cold War at least had a certain emotional logic to it. Hmm. Really, weapons were just the instrument by which this fundamental existential conflict would be dealt with. This is something different. You know, this is a case in which North Korea and the United States, you know, to quote Muhammad Ali, Americans have no quarrel with the North Koreans today. You ask your average American on the street what it is that bothers them about North Korea, and they wouldn't have an answer. I mean, in the sense that, sure, they understand that there's something menacing in their language and that they're obviously very angry at us, but we don't have the feeling that the stakes are visible, that we understand why America is in this confrontation. On the North Korean side, however, there's something different, which is they have an acute, almost encompassing from morning till night sense of being in this constant conflict with the United States. We get up every morning in America and we're aware that we have a nuclear arsenal and we're aware that there is this abstract risk of a war with somebody. But it just is completely far from our lives. There's no reason why we need to be thinking about it. North Korea lives very differently today. They really do get up and think about and talk about and look at on television and on billboards. They look at the weaponry. They look at the images of it. And so whether or not a person wants to or not, it is the oxygen that is available. Mm. And that was a surprise, was to sit down at a lunch table, as I did one day, with Park Sung-il, who is an analyst from the foreign ministry, who I found a very engaging and intelligent sort of docent, really, to North Korea. He was my minder, basically. But a very smart guy who pays a lot of attention to the United States. And he said to me, almost matter-of-factly, that if there is a war with the United States, that not everyone will die, as he put it, in North Korea. He said some people will survive and they will carry on. And I think if I had one regret would be that I wish I had been able to convey to people the sense that among the uncertainties that I began to develop while I was there, one of them was about trying to understand how much of this kind of daily conversation about, you know, Mr. Park saying to me that thousands, as he put it, will survive a nuclear exchange, how much of that was pure bombast and theater and gamesmanship, and how much of that was deeply felt. Because by the end, what I was able to convey to the reader was that I don't know. But what I didn't really say, and I guess I didn't have the courage of my conviction on this, was that I deeply suspect that it really is theater. I do not believe that North Korea is girding itself for a catastrophic nuclear attack. I mean, I can't square it with the humanity that I actually encountered while I was there.
Evan, go back to what Americans think of North Korea. More and more, every day in a way, we're being taught to think of its strangeness itself as the story, sort of like Albania back in the old days, completely isolated society, poor, cruel in many, many details, with this young guy, 33 years old, Kim Jong-un, who loves the Michaels, Jordan and Jackson, and he's had Dennis Rodman, because he's a Bulls fan, visit, but a completely weird guy who didn't hesitate to wipe out his stepbrother by a curious poison attack, as if to say that defines somebody we got to rub out.
Yeah.
Deal with this sort of the wacko picture and who it serves.
You know, to an almost unique degree, we have this tendency to laugh at North Korea because they make it easy for us. I mean, Kim Jong-il with the hair and the elevator shoes and the whole bit. And then on top of it, of course, every time that you would hear about something from North Korea, even when it was true, it was almost beyond fiction. So when we learned, for instance, as we did a number of years ago, that he kidnapped his favorite actress from South Korea, it lent itself to a kind of ridicule. It was impossible to take it seriously. And what happened over time was, I think it actually acculturated us in a dangerous direction where we began to regard North Korea as unserious. And we didn't take even the serious stuff seriously. We don't spend all that much time actually talking about human rights in North Korea. I certainly didn't spend enough time, I think, in this piece talking about it. But that's a massive issue of international consequence. So, you know, yes, there are elements of his persona that are kind of fascinating in a just for the sheer oddity of it. He has, for instance, gone out of his way to physically take on the characteristics of his grandfather. He's put on weight. He's begun to wear the eyeglasses that his grandfather's generation wore. He wears an old man's Panama hat, and he sort of walks like an old man. He puts his hands behind his back and kind of eases along from place to place. And that's partly because his grandfather was a very popular figure. So in a way, you have to cut through the silliness of it to understand that what he's doing is something crucially important for us to understand, which is that he's appealing to the nostalgia of North Koreans about a moment when it was a proud and dignified country. Because to the average North Korean, the late 1960s, when Kim Il-sung ran the country, that was the high point. That was the golden age. You know, they were richer than South Korea. They were much richer than other parts of Asia. They were richer than the Chinese. You know, this was a functioning country that had, as far as they were concerned, you know, high levels of electricity generation and distribution. This was before the nightmare began and their own mismanagement and isolation began to drive them into the state that they're in today. So when you see him doing this kind of some of these things that look antic to us,
right,
they often have an underlying logic to them that only begins to make sense if you put it in the context of their own history.
So interesting, because it has a logic for us too. It all builds up the weirdness picture, but also the fundamental question of, is he a rational actor? Oddly too, that these two strange haircuts, Trump and Kim, are in this confrontation together, and nobody really is sure that either one of them is a rational actor.
Right. The reality is that these two actually have some things in common.
Hmm.
They are both new to politics. You know, together they have a combined 7 years in public office.
Fascinating.
Neither one of them rose up through the ranks of the military or the security services or the political system. And they are both enormously confident in their own judgment and in their own ability to bend the universe as they want it to be. And
if I may say, both picked by their papas for their aggressiveness.
Absolutely. Yeah. Very much so. Yeah, both of them, you know, from the time they were kids, in both cases, we have anecdotal evidence that they were being advised to be aggressive and that eventually the world will drop to its knees if you're tough enough.
Things that come through between the lines, Evan, and gets back to the real substance, I think, for me, were this note that people struck with you, we want to be left alone. Go away. Forget about us. Second point, though, that they, on all sides, there is a certain eagerness for a change relationship. You quote a guy, a scholar, I guess, in Seoul, John DeLury, saying, you know, the problem is the hostile relationship. Get over it.
Yeah.
And anything would be possible. The record of the Clinton, late Bill Clinton administration seemed to be that when there was a chance to drop hostilities, make some deals, they were ready. It was George W. Bush who said, no, we're not going that way.
That's right.
There's a lurking possibility around several corners here.
That's true. And one of the compelling arguments that I've heard comes from James Clapper, who, after all, was director of national intelligence under Barack Obama. He was a Marine. He was then in the Air Force and then, of course, rose up and became the highest ranking intelligence officer in the United States. Not exactly a weak-kneed accommodationist. He fought in Vietnam and then returned 4 decades later and was amazed that the country that was, from his personal experience, you know, on the other side of the world, morally, ideologically, it could never be a partner of the United States. And there it was, 40 years later now, a member of the international community, still a communist country, but no longer in a hostile stance towards the United States.
The Clapper testimony is fascinating. He says the idea of denuclearizing North Korea is a non-starter in the present time. But also Steve Bannon, in the heart of Trump think, says, they got us. Sorry, it's over. They're a nuclear power now.
Yeah.
Short form, Evan Osnos, I mean, would either side in this picture choose to strike the other?
They would choose to start a war if they believed that they were at the imminent risk of attack. That is true. That is something that I came away with. North Korea would not unilaterally choose to launch a war with the United States. But if it believed that it was facing an imminent strike that really represented a serious risk, there's no question in my mind that they would be willing to use the weapons that they've developed. But that's a big condition because they're not delusional. They're not jihadists. They're not kamikazes. They're not suicidal. That's not their mission. That's not their project. Their project is, in fact, to build this very, very poor and beleaguered and addled country into something more like a normal country. And we have to remember that because I think, you know, we've become almost acculturated to the idea of suicidalism, you know, that that's become a fact of our time over the last 15 years. And that's a real, it's danger. It's dangerous to let us kind of, to transplant that conception into North Korea because that's not what they're doing. This is not a holy war for them. This is a war of strategic and military terms.
More Evan Osnos to come this hour, and of course in The New Yorker with Kim Jong-un's haircut on the cover, caption, Warhead. Coming up, our man in the Situation Room, Barry Posen, who runs security studies at MIT and knows all the weapons and the logic inside the weapon heads. This is Open Source. Barry Posen, let the people into the process around North Korea here. Our friend Elaine Scarry says that nuclear politics poisons democracy, kills it, dead. The citizens are outside the game and they're silent. But imagine that they counted. My guess is that they'd love to mark the end of the Korean War after 65 years. They might want the nukes out of the peninsula and maybe U.S. weapons and U.S. politics out of Korea, too. Do they have a case? And who's to argue it for them?
I don't think we should just... We can assume that all the people in all the countries in this region who are affected by this necessarily agree.
Let's talk about American people.
There are some old antipathies here, but the basic question is there some way to cut the Gordian knot? Is there some way to turn this off? You don't hear it suggested very often, and we could talk about why it's not suggested. But one could imagine a political offer from our side that said, you know, you want a treaty of peace. That's something we can talk about. Mm-hmm. You want American troops off the peninsula. That's something we can talk about. But we want all nuclear weapons out of North Korea. And that's something we would have to talk about. Right. And a deal based on those ideas is not at least out of the question in the sense that it suits some of the stated needs of all the parties. Now, I'm suspicious that many parties would say no to the deal, and that would surface an understanding for us of other interests that are in play here.
Wouldn't China, the most important player there, kind of like that? Americans back off, no more nukes?
I think China would quite like this kind of deal because I think one of their fears about North Korea is that North Korea could collapse or be defeated in many different scenarios. But in any scenario where that happens while the Americans are still on the peninsula with the South, there's a good chance the Americans aligned with their southern friends end up on the Chinese border and the Yalu River. And the Chinese don't like the idea of Americans right up on the Yalu River. And in fact, in 1950, American troops reached the Yalu, and the Chinese had been warning us off in a lot of oblique ways. They'd been warning us off. And when they saw that we weren't getting the warning, they attacked us and they gave us a real shellacking. Right. So they fought very hard and took very high casualties to keep us well away from the Yalu. Right. And I think one of their fears is that we could end up at the Yalu. So if there was a deal here that in the end got American troops off the peninsula, it would be in China's interest. And I actually believe it would be in their interest to get rid of North Korean nuclear weapons. Right.
And wouldn't it be nice to have a party to saying the war over Korea is over, finally, as James Clapper told Evan Osnos, 40 years after he fought in Vietnam, it is over, even emotionally for us. And there are lots of Vietnam that will never recover, but we've moved on. Couldn't we do that with Korea?
Well, for the Americans, the Korean War, in terms of whatever it was, is over. Americans didn't even like the Korean War.
We forgot it was the forgotten war, even when it
was
happening.
But I sort of found Evan Osnos' observations about the North's interest here to be a little bit odd, because his own reporting doesn't really reveal that this is a nation of high-tech consumers waiting to happen. The regime in the North does not control power because of its ability to deliver a high standard of living. It controls power because it controls all the ideological story, all the historical story, that they seem to thrive on this stage play of a North Korea under siege, which gives them an argument for why they need to have all this power and need to militarize the society. I don't think that this leader believes he can survive a change like that. And one of the reasons why I think they would decline this offer is in the end, they would be afraid of peace. This elite, I believe, would be afraid of peace. But I would like to find out.
Speak about the North. And specifically my question that Evan didn't deal with, is Kim Jong-un wrong to see an imperial trap here? The U.S. says, come out without your nukes. And Mr. Kim says, yeah, sure, just like Saddam and Gaddafi. Or Iran, even as we speak. President Obama talked Iran into putting its nuclear program on the shelf. And to this day, Iran is getting berated by the U.S. president, the Congress, the Pentagon, on what we know are phony charges of noncompliance, and Iran is still under threat. Kim Jong-un is saying, thank you, I'll just keep my nukes.
Oh, I think that's probably right. And I would add some other...
But that's not crazy.
No, I would add some other observations here, which is that the North is dirt poor and the South is very wealthy. The North isn't particularly technologically sophisticated, even this nuclear weapons. But we got to remember, nuclear weapons themselves, this whole project is 65 years old. It's not like it's esoteric technology. The South is twice as populous as the North, and the South has us and Japan as an enemy. If the North were to fall into a conventional war with the South, nuclear weapons out of the equation, it would only be a matter of time before the North lost. Right. So I can understand why they're looking for a whole card, so long as they believe they're living in a conflict situation, in a conflictual world, a world of power struggles. I can understand why they would want nuclear weapons. And the history that you recount is, in fact, a fair history. You know, when we come around to the idea that a dictator is a pain in the neck for us, then we can rub them out. We do it, and we don't really think twice about it, right? What we don't like is high casualties and high prices for it. And so far, the countries the dictators we've tried to rub out have not really been able to impose particularly high casualties on us. And by the way, I put the Iranians to the side on that. I think we're a little leery about trying to rub out the Iranian regime. I don't think anybody is afraid of bombing them, but I think this idea of regime change in Iran is something that most people, the American elite, understand is going to be very hard to do by the sword. Now, if you can cause a revolution in Iran, it's another story.
Listen for a moment, Barry Posen, to a young scholar who might have been one of your students. Greg Afanogenov got his PhD in Russian history at Harvard. He teaches imperial history now at Georgetown. Here is his short form on the American reign in the world through the last three decades since the Soviet Union collapsed.
So the Cold War ends in 1989 or 91, depending on who you ask. And suddenly the U.S. is alone in the world as superpower with the ability to project its power far beyond its borders across the world. Russia is still a nuclear power, of course, but it doesn't have any ability to effectively resist the U.S. anywhere outside of its immediate neighborhood, and often not even then. So then the question is, if somebody doesn't sign on to the Washington Consensus, doesn't, you know, accept structural reforms and the kinds of economic policies that allow American corporations to come in and take over, what do we do with them? Well, the straightforward solution has been to find a pretext to bomb them, to find a pretext to impose sanctions, and ultimately to find a pretext to invade and change the regime. And of course, the main obstacle to this has been the risk that a regime change operation might carry with it the risk of a nuclear confrontation. So the message that the United States government sends is, because all of our interventions are humanitarian, they're aimed to prevent the loss of civilian life, to overthrow a despotic regime.
Spread freedom.
Freedom, right, exactly. Iraqi freedom. Then anyone who's trying to develop a weapon to prevent those interventions from taking place must be some kind of evil, crazy despot who is manufacturing a weapon to try to stop us from coming in.
North Korea, even as you speak, Greg, sounds more and more like a sequel to something that's been spelling out in Iraq, Libya, in Iran to this day, actively, and now North Korea, another instance.
Absolutely. I mean, we can only hope that North Korea is successful in obtaining a functional nuclear weapon, as it seems to have been. The missile seems to be a different story, but because that's the only scenario in which a catastrophic invasion that was going to cost millions of civilian lives is going to be averted. I think, as far as citizens are concerned, we as participants in a political community, I think the key problem here is the blindness of Americans about foreign policy. I think we're far too willing to accept military solutions, or in the case of many Democrats, military solutions that are veiled in humanitarian language. And we're not willing to actually think about our empire as something that needs to be dismantled comprehensively, as opposed to a series of individual theaters in which foreign policy crises erupt and, you know, when a problem comes around, you must whip it kind of thing. So our kind of instinctive embrace of the projection of American power in any given theater, from Ukraine, where we're supposed to suddenly support giving offensive weapons to the Ukrainian regime, to Syria, to Libya, to North Korea, to Iraq, all of these places, we don't spend much time thinking about them. You know, the classic line is that we can't find them on a map, which seems to be true according to polls. And what the deep state does is essentially it exploits this ignorance, in the sense that these places are irrelevant to us. And so this latest nuclear standoff is suddenly causing so many people to be like, oh, what if North Korea bombs California or Guam? And the sad thing is, that's one of the few moments when we actually think about our foreign policy as having something to do with us back home, as opposed to destroying the lives of those people over there.
Greg, would you sleep better knowing that Kim Jong-un had a nuclear weapon?
Absolutely. And
explain.
Especially if the Iranians had one too. Because it's the same logic there that obtains in the case of Iraq. I mean, the United States has been slavering for war with Iran for decades. And again, this is the axis of evil effect. Iraq is already down. North Korea is being targeted. And Iran has been targeted for decades in speeches and in saber-rattling presentations by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, etc. And if the Iranians have a weapon to protect themselves, then it's yet another invasion and another regime change operation that we can finally avert.
Barry Posen, he's talking about nuclear proliferation as a peace project. Is he crazy?
No, he's not. This is not original to him. There was a very distinguished international relations theorist who happens to have been my mentor, Kenneth Waltz, who made these arguments very often. In the
original so-called realist.
You know, he's really the father of a particular strain of realist international relations theory. And Ken used to make this observation all the time that, you know, it's very hard to use nuclear weapons for aggression, but it's pretty easy to use them for deterrence, right? So countries that think they face really big conventional threats that they themselves can't compete with because they're too poor or too far away, right? Such countries often, you know, they gravitate to nuclear weapons because it's kind of like it's the whole card. It's the magic card. Now,
it's the New Hampshire motto, don't tread on me. Back off.
It's pretty dangerous.
Don't mess with Texas.
Yeah, it's pretty dangerous to tread on a nuclear power, even a small, weak, poor one. And it turns out that, you know, our reaction to North Korea, even without any war or any other bad thing happening, we're sending the message of the world that says, gee, you know, get yourself a couple dozen nuclear weapons, right? And the Americans will suddenly take you very, very seriously. That's the message we're sending here. Now, if you're concerned about nuclear proliferation, this might be one message that you didn't want to send. Right. But somehow we always end up.
I was going to ask you that. I mean, in what sense is the new North Korea crisis, if it is one, a kind of consequence of the last 10, 15, 20, 30 years of American foreign policy?
Well, it's because of North Korea's where one phase of the Cold War, you know, began and persisted. And it's also where the Cold War ended. Right. You can't just attribute it to our post-Cold War foreign policy. But that said, the American post-Cold War foreign policy, we can use different adjectives, it's been rather expansive, right? We felt when the Cold War ended that we were vindicated, that our theory of world history was right, that liberal democracy, capitalism, international trade, free flow of information, all these good things traveled together, and this was the right way to live, and it was the right way to organize your society. After all, the Cold War competition proved it. The bad guys collapsed, or like the Chinese, began to emulate the West, right? And the West triumphed. And the Cold War ended with us on these ramparts that we had been out on for a long time all over the world defending against the Soviets. Now, you had two choices at that moment. As my good friend Harvey Sapolsky used to say, let's have a parade. He wanted to have a victory parade and bring the troops home when the Cold War ended. And he knew there was a narrow window for the parade because if we didn't have it soon, right, the ramparts were going to become a frontier. And we know what Americans do with frontiers. We go out from frontiers. That's what we do, right?
Why didn't we have the celebration?
Oh, we didn't have the celebration for two reasons. We were really, really powerful. Really powerful. So the world is your oyster. And second of all, we had these ideas. I mean, you know, I'm not a big advocate of ideas, theories in international politics, but we had organized ourselves and our world and our coalition in a certain way, and we thought it was a vindication. And this, you know, the great, I don't want to say fancy, but the dream of liberalism is that politics can be rendered rational and international politics can be rendered peaceable and states can act like reasonable people living under law, right? This is what American liberals imagine is could have been the future of international politics. I mean, when Evan talked about the end of ideology did not end for us when the Cold War ended. Great vast vistas were opened for us to explore and project and export our ideology. And, you know, NATO enlargement, which at the time we used to call NATO expansion, the consequences of which we're living with today. Everyone's worried about giant Soviet military exercises that could threaten our important allies, the Baltic states. Well, the Baltic states were part of the Soviet Union before. It wasn't justified. It wasn't nice. But they're now in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. We rolled the entire border eastward. Right. And in other parts of the world, we did somewhat similar things. Right. So that was our post-Cold War project. And, you know, my argument is that, you know, the project was unnecessary. It's costly. And it's also in many respects self-defeating.
Well, and the cheering stopped so long ago now, and certainly in the Iraq War. I'd like you to speak to that 20-30 year project overall, and the picture that we had of ourselves, it was not of the winners. It's almost comical when you look at the headlines, and people have compiled them, but, you know, Putin always has a takeover plan for everything. Kim Jong-un, of all people, has a grand design, but Uncle Sam in the headlines just keeps getting dragged or sucked or trapped or just blunders willy-nilly into one quagmire after another against his own generous good intentions and all this sort of thing. What is the pattern you see in this record? And or is it just one damn thing after another? Or as the Brits used to say, a fit of absent-mindedness in all of our power out there?
I don't think it's a fit of absent-mindedness. We had a rather desultory but I would say real discussion in the American foreign policy establishment when the Cold War ended about what to do. Mm-hmm. And most people, in the establishment, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, really did want to view the ramparts that we had defended as the frontiers that we were now going to go beyond. Right? That was what they mostly believed. Hmm. And people who didn't believe that, and I was one of them, were in a minority. I mean, it was very hard in the argument over NATO enlargement to get a word into the public discourse that this might not be such a good idea. Right. Mm. So this was who we are, and I think we did it because it embedded in our notion of ourselves was this transformational idea that international politics, you know, the war of all against all, the competition of great powers, that at this moment we had a magic moment to banish all that.
Yep.
Right. If we could only use American power for good, and there was lots of American power. Right, Madeleine Albright, the indispensable nation. Right, that's what we were. Right, and that was an agreed,
and a very dangerous slogan. No, I mean,
yes, extremely dangerous. Although Americans, even to this day, don't quite get how dangerous it is.
Barry Posen, stand by. We're talking about what may be a very grave crisis around North Korea. Maybe not. Coming up. Once upon a time, a popular nuclear freeze movement got Ronald Reagan, of all people, to say in his State of the Union speech in 1984 that a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. So why do we still have these weapons? This is Open Source. Evan Osnos, of the now famous New Yorker piece from Pyongyang, told us this week that he came home in a mood of befuddlement. But the absurdities he reported are not the whole story.
You know, my mood is actually not as dark and apocalyptic as you might expect after spending a few months talking about nuclear war. These are not two ships without captains. These are actually two powers that are struggling. They're struggling to figure out a way to coexist. What leaves me with tremendous uncertainty was that so much of the problem of nuclear brinkmanship depends on matters of the mind. Mm. It depends on what we imagine of the other, and not only what we imagine of the other, but what we imagine the other imagines of us. And that is extremely hard when you're dealing with a country like North Korea that goes out of its way to be misleading. And then, of course, on our side, we are in our own ways are misleading.
All of it takes us back, as you note, to Thomas Schelling and this image of nuclear deterrence as two rock climbers strapped to each other on a ledge. Who's going to jump?
Right.
Whose interest would it be to jump? But so you bluff and you approach the edge again. I mean, it is madness.
Yeah. So I'll tell you one thing that I think is really interesting, it's kind of a long-term point, is that one of the other things that Schelling famously gave us, Schelling, of course, was the Nobel Prize winner who developed the theory of deterrence.
An economist.
Economist at Harvard and at the University of Maryland. He was brilliant on the subject of helping us understand what we had made with atomic weapons and the idea that we would then be engaged in this new kind of psychological dynamic. One of the things that he said, it was a famous experiment that he did. It was about understanding how two different groups of people or multiple groups of people who don't have any contact with each other, as in the case of the U.S. and North Korea, where we have no diplomatic relations, we don't have arms control talks going on, how do they communicate? And the way he demonstrated this was a famous experiment where he had his students meet in New York City. And all he told them was meet in New York City. He didn't tell them where, and he didn't tell them exactly the location. And each of the students went away and in their own way thought of all the conceivable possibilities, and they ended up meeting by a kind of silent, unanimous choice. They ended up meeting at the kiosk in Grand Central Station, at the famous information kiosk right
That's
there.
That's pretty good.
And it's developed what's known as the focal point theory, which is that on a level we don't talk about, that's where we're heading. And I think the risk here is that by talking about nuclear weapons in the way that Donald Trump and that Kim Jong-un have, they run the risk of changing our focal point as a people. I mean, as a species, quite literally, that we no longer believe that nuclear weapons are off the table. That used to be the focal point.
Right.
You know, the idea that they were just so abominable that they could never be used. And now we've allowed them to creep into our calculus of national security decision making. And that is the thing that worries me more, Chris, is the idea that we have allowed nuclear weapons to get back to a seat at the table where they shouldn't be.
Admiration and thanks to Evan Osnos of The New Yorker magazine. How is it then that the nukes are at the table again, the people nowhere near the agenda? Beatrice Fine runs the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons. ICAN, so-called, lobbied for the UN treaty adopted in July that put nukes under the same ban as biological, chemical, and other weapons of mass destruction.
We shouldn't try to make this about a political issue, you know, liberal versus conservative or things like that. This has to do with, is it acceptable to slaughter civilians in warfare? It is not. We have agreed on international laws regulating that, saying that you shouldn't target civilians. Nuclear weapons only target civilians. I mean, that's what they're so big. They're meant to wipe out cities.
Climate, race, women drive big popular movements these days. Where are the nuclear abolitionists?
It is growing, and I think it's definitely growing now in light of what's going on between North Korea and the United States. And people are getting worried because it is very strongly connected to all of these other issues as well. In particular, it's connected to power dynamics. A very few group of states, only 9 of them, have decided to hold the ultimate power, in a way, over life and death of the entire world. I mean, they could destroy the entire world if they wanted to. And the rest of the world is just left standing on the sidelines. And we've been working with this new treaty that is going to be opening for signature next week at the United Nations that prohibits nuclear weapons, much like biological and chemical weapons. And it has been driven by the non-nuclear armed states, those states without nuclear weapons. And as in all power struggles, in a way, whether it's the fight against apartheid or women's right to vote or civil rights movement, it's not the most powerful people that lead these movements. It has to be demanded from others. Countries in Africa, countries in Latin America. So this is also about equality. The nuclear armed states, those that benefit from this power, have been so furious about this treaty. And they say it doesn't matter because they're not a part of it. But they have been working so hard to try to stop it, which also shows that they do think it matters. Trump's UN ambassador has held press conferences and protests outside conference rooms in the UN saying that this is meaningless. But they would never do that if it was meaningless. You have this big majority of states, and it has happened before. They did the same thing with landmines. They banned landmines despite resistance from China, Russia, the United States. They banned cluster munitions without those countries being a part of it. And now we're doing it with nuclear weapons. And I think that there's also a sense of empowerment amongst all of these states that we can set the rules.
That UN nuclear ban is still to be signed and ratified. Beatrice Fine, Swedish by birth, spoke to us from Geneva this week. John Carl Baker is an American in the same abolitionist movement, a doctor of cultural studies, research fellow at the Plowshares Fund. Welcome, John Carl Baker.
Hi.
I looked it up. It's easy. 193 nations in the United Nations, just 9 in the nuclear club, now including North Korea. Will the 9 be held accountable? Can they be?
Yes, I think they can be. I think the particular genius of the ban treaty that Beatrice was just talking about was that it really recasts the 9 as the outliers. They are the rogue states, and they love to throw that term around, but this really shows that they are a tiny, tiny minority, which, as she said, possesses world-destroying power. And if there ever was to be a nuclear war, you know, everyone else would be subject to it. All of the other countries on Earth who are not nuclear-armed states, the very countries that are in favor of the ban, that participated in the ban process, they are the vast majority of states on Earth, and they are the ban treaty is an excellent example of them sort of collectively refusing to go along with the danger that the nuclear-armed states possess and propagate. And I will say that it's not just a symbolic move, although there clearly is heavy symbolism to it. This has the intent of pressuring the nuclear-armed states to return to their obligations that they've signed on to as part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty to make a good-faith effort to disarm, which they have really not done in recent years. I mean, there has been a major decline in the number of nuclear weapons on Earth since the Cold War, but particularly in the last several years, there really hasn't been any progress. And this is an attempt to jumpstart progress from outside the kind of metropole, outside of the sort of these major nuclear-armed states, and bring them to the table, get them to actually do what they're supposed to do and make our world a lot safer.
That's a cultural battle too, John, to get the world to think of those rich countries like Britain, France, United States, Russia too, and the hugely populous countries like China and India as the rogues. But could it happen? How would you do it?
It's going to be difficult, and I think the best way to think about this ban treaty is that this is, I mean, it's something to be celebrated, but this is the beginning of the process. And it's going to take actors from within those states to, you know, hold their leaders accountable, and that's going to be one of the defining features. I mean, clearly the international playing field is important here, all of those states that were involved in the ban treaty process. But ultimately, it's also going to take constituencies within those states pressuring their leaders to actually, you know, push for arms control, reduce the number of nuclear weapons that they have. I do think there are prospects for that. I think that social movements feed off of one another, and certainly in the Obama years, we've really seen an explosion of social movements. And in the Trump era, you know, just in the past few months, we've really seen how the power that they accumulated can be flexed. And these groups tend to be located on the left side of the political spectrum. They're skeptical of military power. They're in favor of social spending rather than defense spending. And I think that, you know, they're already sort of passive supporters of nuclear disarmament in a lot of ways. What has to happen is they have to become active supporters. And, you know, that's going to be a long-term process, but it's definitely something that's possible. And, we may see evidence of it in short order.
It's going to have to be embodied someday in a figure as compelling as Trump, and alliances will have to be built. But Barry Poston, I want your take on abolitionism in this field.
Well, as I like to admit, I have been wrong before. I think despite the activity of the United Nations, as a practical matter, I think this wave has crested for now. It's easy to forget every one of the permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, the ones with the veto in the Security Council, every one of them is a nuclear weapons state.
Yep.
And not a single one of them, as far as I can tell, has any interest in stopping being a nuclear weapons state. Right? Now,
they have to be pried out of their hands for sure. But
yes, but you have to ask the question why they don't want them pried out of their hands. And one reason is that at least many of us who've thought about this for a while believe is that for the same reason that you suggest that Kim Jong-un wants nuclear weapons because they can deter stronger states from attacking you, great powers like to be able to deter other great powers from attacking them, right? It's not wise, just as Kim Jong-un can't remember the horrors that were visited. He wasn't there, but it's in the establishment there. They can't remember forget the horrors that were visited upon them in the Korean War.
Right.
The thousands and thousands, if not millions, of tons of bombs were dropped. I don't even know how many, right? But huge
we
numbers.
We know that
huge numbers.
The casualties
huge
were,
numbers.
The deaths were 20% of the population.
Tremendous. The first half of the 20th century for the advanced West was a giant abattoir. The Americans got off light, right? Our abattoir was the Civil War, right? Now, this is in the age of conventional weapons, right? Conventional weapons seem to get used. Nuclear weapons seem to not get used. Now, why is that, right?
Well, John Carbaker, get ready to jump back in here.
And this is one reason, is because the consequences of nuclear weapons use are pretty clear. It's very hard for even the cleverest, most sort of satirically imagined briefer to come up with an argument for how nuclear victory is going to be achieved. You can see that American military people don't even try and do it vis-a-vis North Korea to come up with an argument that the war would somehow assuredly be cheap and clean and fast and smooth, right? They don't imagine a war with North Korea to look this way. And great powers, whether they have 200, 500, 1,000, 1,500, 2,000, however many nuclear weapons, it's very hard to make the victory argument. Now, in 1940, people could. In 1941, they could. In 1914, they could. We don't want to have military systems in the hands of advanced technology states that allow clever briefers to make the cheap, easy, fast victory argument. That's what nuclear weapons have taken out of the equation of great power politics.
You'd still take them away, John. Explain.
I would say...
On what schedule, too?
Two things in response to that. The first one is that, you know, first off, nuclear weapons haven't been around that long. And I've heard this argument before, and there is some validity to it, the idea that nuclear weapons have, you know, halted the sort of like, stopped in some way the huge deaths, right, that resulted as a result of conflicts like World War I and World War II. But the first thing I would say is that downplays the millions of people who died as a result of the Cold War, many of which were in the global south, right? And many of them are now participating in the Ban Treaty process. So, you know, the existence of nuclear weapons hasn't done away with huge amounts of deaths. It may have decreased it in some form in the short term.
If those people in the global south that had nuclear weapons, I guarantee you we wouldn't bomb the hell out of them.
I think to some degree you're right, but let me say, like I said, in the short term. In the long term, it's a matter of risk, you know? Maybe deterrence works in the short term. Maybe there is a way in which it prevents large-scale conflict. But we better be sure that that's the case. If you have those weapons out there, there's always going to be a risk that one of them goes off. And that's something that would be an utter catastrophe and potentially could lead to a full-scale nuclear exchange, even a real kind of full-scale nuclear war. And the question I would ask people is that, are you safe with that risk being out there? People in the disarmament field would say, look, I'm not okay with that. This is something we as a sort of global society have got to take care of. It's the risk is, as long as the risk is out there, the potential catastrophe is just too great. Barry may disagree with me. I would imagine he does disagree with me. But that's the argument against it. Risk is out there, there's potential for catastrophe.
It's not just Barry who disagrees with you. We've been invoked the name of the great Thomas Schelling. Thomas Schelling twice wrote articles, very persuasive and pointed articles, about why a world of zero would be a rather dangerous world. And the problem with a world of zero is the North Koreans are another wonderful case teaching us a lesson, right? If the North Koreans can invent and deploy nuclear weapons for themselves, then how are we going to fix it so that in the aftermath of a nuclear disarmament agreement, we can be sure that no one state is cheating, right? That no one state is cheating. And if by some chance a state is trying to surreptitiously rebuild a nuclear weapons capability, even a small one, if they have a jump on everyone else, they're going to be sorely tempted to use it. It's an extremely unstable situation. If you want a situation where the odds of nuclear use are high, that is also a situation where the odds of nuclear use are high. This is the problem. We live in the nuclear age. You can't undo it.
We hate it, though. It's a terrible, terrible time. Go back to Dr. Waltz. What about one nuclear weapon per country under heavy lock and key and careful inspection, but there to enforce non-invasions?
Well, this has been a certain kind of, I won't call it an arms controller's dream. This is, you've caricatured it, but in a sense, this has been the dream of a certain class of nuclear strategists, and I guess I'm among them, right? There is a problem with nuclear weapons, right? And that is we put them in the hands of military organizations who sometimes have a hard time breaking out of a non-nuclear mindset. They think about ways to operate the forces.
I got to ask you before we're done, Barry, on a scale of 1 to 10, how grave in your mind is this uncompleted North Korean crisis?
I think it's about a 3.
Wow.
It's not 1, but it's not 10.
That's the North Korean military parade in the background. Thank you, Barry Posen and John Carl Baker. Thanks also to Evan Osnos, Greg Afanogenov, and Beatrice Fine. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, and Becca DiGregorio. Susan Coyne is our online illustrator, and she's marvelous. George Hicks is another marvel, our engineer. Mary McGrath is our supreme leader. You can tell by the haircut. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.